Launch all sequence has started.
Crew one for all.
Welcome to Moon Snacks,
the place where we explore the connection of life through movies.
My name is Jessica. I'm with my co-pilot, Ed.
It's great to be here with you, Jessica.
And we are here sending some world leaders in their fields to the moon. And by hearing their three movies that they're going to take with them, we get to know them a little bit. We learn life skills, leadership skills, collaborative skills, and also what makes a good story. And today we have a very special guest.
Well, I'm really excited about having, you know, Doug here to talk BFI, so to be able to listen to someone who has this kind of expertise, knowledge curation of movies. I love it. And to learn about some older movies and how we select them for restoration. I'm just, I'm stoked about it.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Doug, can you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
My name is Douglas Weir. I am a Glaswegian. I am a Scotsman. I live in London. I work for the British Film Institute. And my full job title is the Content Remastering and Delivery Lead, which a lot of people say so it makes it sound like a work in the Royal Mail sorting office, which it kind of does. Basically, we've got one of the biggest distribution libraries in Europe, if not maybe the world, and that includes contemporary cinema, as well as all the classics, world classics, British classics, going all the way back to the beginning of the silent era. And my job is basically whenever they decide what they want to do and what they call their cultural program, which they set out for 3 years or so in advance, I have to basically get those films and make them available. And sometimes it means finding the film materials. Sometimes I bring films to the table because obviously you can't plan to release a film if you don't know it exists. So sometimes I come across films that have been missing for a long time and say we should release this, and we end up remastering it and restoring it. So that could be anything from scanning reels of Super 8, 16mm, 35mm, I've done 70mm projects, 9.5, you name it, from all the different archives, including the National Film Archive, which is a part of the British Film Institute. And the National Film Archive is the biggest film collection, or one of the biggest film collections and oldest film archives in the world. And if you Google National Film Archive, you'll see all the great shots of the huge tomb-like film vaults. It's quite amazing. 50-foot high racking of cans of film. So I work with our archive and lots of different archives, finding the material, having it scanned, cleaned up, restored, working with our partner laboratories here in London and internationally. And sometimes it's not film. Sometimes it's videotape or old videotape. Sometimes it's a VHS. Sometimes it's a Laserdisc. That is all that exists.
Doug, this is such a visual episode. I just want to let people know, Ed, you have not stopped smiling.
I lead on about two or three projects a year. Gregory's Girl being an example, which we released in August. That was a few years in the works. So we went back, found the original camera negative, scanned it in 4K, restored it. I know the director, so we worked with him. And then we've got the booklets, and you're working with academics, and I do some writing, and different people write for it. And then there's filming thing, but new interviews. And then there's going through the archives, finding great archive interviews. I found an amazing archive interview with Bill Forsyth, the director. And it's the only copy. I had it on VHS. I found this VHS. This is a good story, actually. It's really random. It's a VHS that I've got crates of stuff at work in the cover, you know, stuff, as you can guess. I had a VHS, and it was an interview with Bill Forsyth by school kids in Glasgow, made by the Glasgow City Council in the early 90s. And it was the only copy. And the reason I got hold of that is because when Richard Attenborough died, his VHS collection ended up in my office because they're like, what do we do with this? Send it to the BFI. And they came to the BFI and they went, what do you want with this? Send it to Doug. And a lot of it was just like stuff you already had, but there were some things in there. I thought, I'll take these. And that was one of them. I forgot about it. And then that's now on the Blu-ray that came out in August. If you want to learn about the craft of a filmmaker like him, That's the best interview I've seen. And I've seen every interview with Bill Frisai. And I've spoken to him about filmmaking extensively. And that is the best. I think he's better in that than anything he ever told to me over a pint, you know? I'm leading on one at the minute, which is going to be premiering at the Glasgow Film Festival in 2 weeks, called Big Banana Feet. And that is actually a print from my own collection of film elements. And it's one of the only two film prints in the world of this film about Billy Connolly. And it's a documentary made about him in the mid-70s, just as he's becoming famous. He's still just a regular guy playing tunes and saying funny stories. And a Scottish director, one of the most important Scottish filmmakers, actually, Murray Grigger, decided to follow him on and put him on an Irish tour and follow him and film it handheld on 16 mil. And all the materials went missing, and it was a missing film for decades. And then I came across a print and bought it for 50 quid off this guy that didn't know what he had. And then Murray's got a copy of his own film print, but unfortunately it's stuck in an archive in California. But the only reason it's in an archive in California is because in the 70s he went over there with his film print to try and get funding for another film, and he couldn't fit it in his luggage, so he just gave it to somebody because he thought, well, there'll be other prints, but there wasn't. We've been restoring that, and it's taken 4 or 5 years, and it's showing again in Glasgow in a few weeks. I'll be there with Murray introducing it, and then it's going to get a release in cinemas in the UK in May. You know, really the most important thing for me, it could just get a DVD release or one showing in a cinema, but ultimately a film like, I mean, Gregory's Girl is not a missing film. It's a very, very popular film, and it's fine. But Big Banana Feet is what it's called, the documentary that we're releasing. The important thing about that, and there was another film last year called Dance Craze, which was all about two-tone scam music movement in the UK, and that was a 70 mil print. The ultimate goal for me is to drag it across that finish line, and it ends up in an archive preserved. So as long as it gets restored or remastered, or even if it's not, as long as those film materials end up somewhere safe and they're not on the market for 50 quid somewhere, yeah, that's the important thing for me anyway.
What's your holy grail that you'd love to bring back?
I don't know the answer because I never know what's coming up. These films that just land in your lap, you just don't expect them.
Yeah, we're going to dive in. I mean, you asked the why. The why is important. Why are we sending you to the moon? It's basically what we do with our favorite people.
One of the natural things that humans look for, in addition to love, is exploring and finding new places. That's why we love to travel. And so eventually we'll be at the point where we can start going to different places in the universe. And we want to take our art with us. And what's more important, art than cinema?
Well, I think we've got a lot in common because I believe that you can travel through art. That's how a lot of people travel. If you're housebound, I work for a Scottish charity where I help out elderly people, and I always think a lot of them are housebound, and but a lot they're all big readers, big writers, some of them. They like to paint, and I think you can travel through art. And we all travel through films if you're a movie fan, or you travel through music. I mean, I'm a massive Star Trek nerd because it travels. I get to travel to other planets and meet guys with really bad prosthetics, you know?
When I started working at NASA, I remember there's a directorate that I got to read, and it made me very emotional because it felt as aspirational and as inclusive and wonderful as Star Trek itself. It gave me the chills that actually living in Los Angeles, where you're surrounded by all these huge studios that claim that they're dream factories, they're really not. They're totally risk averse. And then here you are at NASA, which is the true dream factory. It's a place of innovation and creativity and taking risks and collaboration. Yeah, so.
What is it Captain Kirk said? Risk is our business. I like that.
So, what is the first movie that you're going to take with you?
The first film I'd like to talk about, Jessica and Ed, is Local Hero, the Scottish film by Bill Frisai.
Half a million pounds is a lot of money, Ben. Even enough to buy another beach with. Look, I've got some postcards. I've got some very fine beaches here. I want to make you an offer. How about this? Any beach that takes your fancy, anywhere in the world, I'll get for you. Look at this. Hawaii. I can get you 5 or 6 miles of Hawaii, no problem. Or, look here, Australia. Look at that sand. Oh, yes. They look like very nice beaches, Mr. McIntyre. But see, I only need the one. I have this here. I don't need another one. Besides, I'm not sure that there's a living in any of these beaches. I mean, you've got to go into that kind of thing in detail. I'll buy you any beach you want.
On the front of every page of the script that Bill gave to all the cast and crew, he wrote the poem by W.H. Davies, Poor life this if, full of care, we have no time to stand and stare, which I think, you know, that affects me quite deeply, that. And so does the film. And it's a film that I rewatched with my partner just at the weekend because she had never seen it. And I've seen it a lot of times. But do you know when you've got a film that you love so much, you deliberately don't watch it a lot? Because you don't want to become over familiar with it. I've got a lot of films like that I refuse to watch over. You hear about people going, I love The Avengers, I've watched it 12 times. And you go, well, you've made two big mistakes there. And this is the thing I was struggling with, the whole moon concept. Because I thought, why do I want to take a film to the moon that makes me sad? And it makes me sad because it makes me homesick. Because I spent half my youth on the Western Isles of Scotland. It's filmed in that area. It's also a very, very soulful film. It's got a lot to say about nature. It's got a lot to say about being a human being. There's no bad person in the film. It's a really, really well-written film. It's a really interesting film. The main character is the protagonist throughout the whole film. But then at the end of it, he becomes the antagonist and you feel bad for him. And he's sent home to Houston to sort out something else. It's all about isolation. It's all about loneliness. And it's all about finding yourself. It's the only film I can think of that really shows the west coast of Scotland and its people in a faithful light, rather than what we call rank tartanry, which I've just spent a good 6 months working on the season of the Powell and Pressburger films at the BFI, and they are great, but I've got a bee in my bonnet about I Know Where I'm Going, which is a beautiful film. It's a beautiful film, but to me, it doesn't depict Scotland or Scotland's people.
Cloran.
I'll just tell you one thing that annoys me. So I got a twin brother. He lives in Tobermory, right? There is no such thing as Killoran, but there is now because some rich person's built a house and called it Killoran House. So there is now a Killoran House on the Isle of Mull, and that's kind of annoying because it's mythology becoming fact through a bad film. I'm sorry I said it. I don't like it as a film. I think it's a beautiful film, but I don't like the way it depicts Scottish people. In the 1970s, when Bill made That Sinking Feeling and really started the Scottish film industry properly, that's when we started to see real Scottish people on screen from the 70s onwards, or late 70s onwards. Prior to that, they were all very sort of God-fearing, very humble, subservient. I was like, these aren't my people. But then when you watch a Bill Forsyth film, you go, oh, that's my voice. I recognise this, I recognise that person, I recognise this area, I recognise this humour. Yeah, Loco Hero, I think it's Bill Forsyth's best film. I think he's made quite a few great films, but I think it's where it all comes together. That Sinking Feeling is probably the best Glasgow film ever made, and it's probably the most Glaswegian film ever made. It was the first ever Scottish, fully indigenously funded fiction film. Before that, funding for Scottish cinema, there wasn't any. It was for documentaries from the government through what's called the Films of Scotland. And a lot of the guys that made these Films of Scotland documentaries promoting shipbuilding, fishing, industrial pursuits, they went into making these fiction films with Bill and other films. There was like literally seven guys in the doublet in Glasgow who were the film industry in Scotland in the 70s. And it was Bill Forsyth, Charlie Gormley, Murray Gregor, Patrick Higson, and then a few more, and David Peat, the cameraman. They went from documentary filmmaking into making feature films, but That Sinking Feeling was the first one. And it's a really funny little Glasgow street film. And it was made for £6,000, and it was funded by Iron Brew, Tenants Caledonian, postal orders from unions. So that's a great film. And then he went and made Gregory's Girl, which is kind of the next step up. But Gregory's Girl is a classic. But then for me, Local Heroes, where it all comes together, it's in full bloom. And he did make great films after that. He made Housekeeping, which is a great film. It's the only film I think he adapted from a novel. Yeah, Local Hero, just because it gives me a warm, fuzzy feeling. But also, you know, it's so in touch with the environment as well, and it's talking about a lot of environmental concerns that are still massively relevant today.
But you said that so beautifully, and I really want to highlight that sense of place, whether through the environment, through the heart of the people, through the authenticity, through the fact that no one's turned into an archetype. Everyone seems to be a person in it.
He's the only filmmaker I know of that can really nail it, that the fact that in life there is no antagonist or protagonist. You are both of those things all the time. Every time I show that film to somebody, they sometimes come out confused because they don't know what they've just watched. And that's kind of the point. There's a lot going on, but there's also not a lot going on. And you have to be a bit one step ahead, really.
I like picturing you on the moon and having kind of that sense of place and home kind of rooted through this movie. And I'm just curious, Doug, in the work that you do, you mentioned growing up in the Western Isles. Do you think that sense of place informed your sensibility, your artistic sensibility?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm actually from Glasgow. I grew up in Glasgow, but spent most of my holidays and everything else in the west coast of Scotland in a place called Morven, which is a very special place because it's one of the truly last remote parts of Scotland, because it doesn't have a really main road going into it. It's a strange peninsula, and then it's kind of cut off by a ferry that always breaks down. And it's absolutely abundant with wildlife. I was in Orkney Christmas, and I was chatting to someone. They're going, oh, pine martens, you know, they're really rare. And I said, are they? Because where my mum and dad live, you put a jam on toast and there's 100 of them turn up and have a tea party. And they said, well, where do they live? And I said, in Morven. They went, ah, that explains, because the ecosystem there is different as well. It's got one of the rare examples of Scottish rainforest, and the biodiversity up there is really unique. It's got the last wildcats in Scotland are there as well. I think it does inform a lot of things. I think everybody's youth informs a lot of things because we're always trying to get back there. There's a great Lemmy sketch. I don't know if anybody who doesn't know Lemmy. Lemmy's a Scottish comedian who had a sketch show on the BBC, and you should watch him on YouTube. It's very funny. But he had this great sketch where it's him, and he goes into the train station in Glasgow somewhere, and he's got a photograph from his childhood, and it's Largs, you know, Largs on the coast of Scotland, which is a holiday town on this coast of Scotland. And he goes up to the woman in the ticket booth and says, oh, I'd like to go here, please. And she goes, oh, it's £10 one-way ticket, or ticket to Largs, return. He went, no, I want to go here. And she goes, oh, it's a ticket, you want a return or a single? He says, I don't think you understand, I want to go here. And then the woman goes, well, I can't. She realises, she goes, I can't take you there. And in a way, to me, that's what films do. They, you know, they take you there. So in a way, Local Hero takes me there because I can only get there once or twice a year at the moment because I live in London.
Paired with that, what are you taking along with Local Hero?
The next quote in my jotter is, cinema is an improvement on life, as said by Francis Truffaut, or François Truffaut, who is my favourite French filmmaker. And one of my favourite film series of all time is what's called the Antoine Doinel cycle, which is from the 400 Blows up to a film called Love on the Run. And it is 400 Blows, then there's a short film, then there's a film called Stolen Kisses, then there's a film called Bed and Board, and then there's Love on the Run. So there's five films, including one short. And the film I'm choosing from that is not the 400 Blows. It's the sequel to it, Baisser Volley. French said in my best Scottish accent, Baisser Volley.
Ben écoutez, on pourrait commencer par enquêter, par exemple, dans votre magasin. Je peux placer un périscope.
Un périscope?
Oui, un périscope, c'est...
Enquête, recherche, filature.
Espion? Non. Détective privé.
So in the 400 Blows, it's about a child who basically doesn't fit in, struggles at school with academia, struggles with everything, and his parents are not the best parents, and they end up basically kicking him into military academy. Then Stolen Kisses, he comes out of military academy. It is filmed about 10 years later, but throughout all these films, it's the same actor getting older. And he ages with the character, which is great. I mean, it's a great concept, which is very, you know, I think it's been done a few times since, but I think this is the first time it was done. Played by Jean-Pierre Léaud. In Stolen Kisses, he comes out of military prison and basically arrives in Paris like it's a blank canvas. And he's in his military uniform. He's got nothing else. He goes into his little studio flat and everything's covered in dust. And he's like a toy car and there's old photographs. And obviously that when he lived there, he was a child, you know, a delinquent child. And now he's come out an adult. I remember the first time I saw it was about 20 years ago on BBC Four or something like that. Well, that didn't exist back then, but it was BBC. They were doing a French cinema season. And I turned it on randomly and I instantly just connected with this character because I think at that time I just arrived in London and I didn't know anybody and I was 19. Well, so it would be 25 years ago. And I think I connected with it because of that. And also because the character's a bit of a buffoon and not in a comedy. It's not a comedy, though it is funny. It's a comedy in the same way that Local Heroes are comedy, in that it's comedy in a very natural, normal way, not in a forced way. It's basically about him trying to fit in as an adult, having missed out that whole period of his life where he would have been doing that. And I think I relate to that because I never went to university. I never did any of that academia. I never mixed with people my own age. I just went straight into work because I wanted to. I wanted to go to London and work in film archives and work with old movies. And I think I connected with it in that sense. And also because the character, like all blokes in their early 20s, he's a bit of an idiot. We're all kind of twats. I mean, it's true. He's falling in love with the wrong woman. He's doing the wrong things. He's got the wrong jobs. He's wearing the wrong clothes. And he's listening to the wrong music. You're kind of, I think everybody, and I say this to anybody who's a bloke and he's in his early 20s or mid-20s or whatever, or you're in your 20s, whatever you're doing right now, as much as you love it and you think it's great, you're doing the wrong thing. You're doing the wrong thing. Maybe you're doing the right course or the right job, so that's all right. But fundamentally, the way you move through life, it's not there yet. You're not there yet. You're doing the wrong thing.
Gail Sheehy, the developmental psychologist, says that your first adulthood doesn't begin until you're like 28 or 32, somewhere between there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You suddenly find your feet on solid ground and you don't even know it. And you go, oh, I've arrived. And you're like, I'm 36. But then you think, well, but you still have a great time and you wouldn't change it for anything else. But you do have that feeling in your 20s where you think, this is great, I've done it. And you're like, no, you haven't. And that film really encapsulates it for me, our complete naivety to the world and love and professional, you know, your profession and everything. And how at the end of the day, as Armand Iannucci puts it, we're just all twats. And that's the British word. Sorry, I'm not swearing. That's the British word, which means idiot.
In your 20s, were you doing restoration?
My background as a kid was photography with my mum. My mum's a photographer. And when I was a kid, I was not academic at all. I've got very bad dyslexia. Well, I don't have bad dyslexia because dyslexia is a positive thing in lots of ways, but I've got a lot of dyslexia. And back then, obviously, you don't know how to manage it. I do now. And I just didn't get on at school. And back then, in the late 80s, early 90s in Scotland, dyslexia wasn't a thing. It was like, you know, it was like a fairy tale thing. So I didn't really go to school a lot. And my mum used to take me to on photography assignments and write a sick note for me for when I went back to school. So I spent a lot of my youth with my mum setting up shots. She was commissioned by Glasgow City Council to photograph all the buildings that were being restored in the early 90s when they were doing the Glasgow City of Culture. And I would go around with her as a little kid helping her photograph those. And then you'd hang out in the film labs in Glasgow smelling all the processing, and then that obviously that's what you're nostalgic for, and that's what I wanted to do. I remember buying some videotapes for the summer holidays, and I got remember the double VHSs. I got a double VHS because it was so bloody long of Lawrence of Arabia, which is one of my favourite films, which was almost one of the three, by the way. Because it's just such a as a film that is so stunning, it brings tears to my eyes. But the politically it's problematic, but it's a beautiful film. Technically, nothing has ever been as... Directors have strived to be as good as that, but nobody has. In the end of the videotape, there was a little thing, because they restored Lawrence of Arabia in 1989. Steven Spielberg and David Lean and... what's his name? Robert Harris, or the well-known film restoration guy. They restored it, and they did a little video piece about how they restored it. And around that time, the Star Wars films were being... what they call it, special edition or whatever. But there was a shot in one of these things about Star Wars being restored of the film going through cleaning tanks. And I was like, what's going on here? And then I saw the Lawrence of Arabia piece where they're going, we restored the film. And I'm thinking, why did Lawrence of Arabia need restoring? What's this? And then I learned about it. I was already collecting Super 8 films. And I realized, this is a thing. So I can get to be with old movies and film. I mean, I'm fascinated by film as a physical medium and moving images as well. In fact, probably more so than movies themselves, because there are many more people way more educated and learned in films than I am. I'm more into the, because I'm a technician. Okay, there's a way I can do this and get paid. I studied animation for a while in Scotland just to learn about moving images and how images move and how it works with your brain. This was at 18, 19. And then I thought, right, see ya. I'm off to the National Film Archive. They're going to pay me nothing. Well, very, very little amount of money to be, you know, an assistant. And I remember going through the doors of the film archive. In fact, I was with a colleague of mine last night at the BFI who was working there when I arrived at 19, and we were chatting about it. I said, I remember walking in the Oxbury optical printer, which is a machine that basically makes cop film duplicates. And it's a beautiful big thing, and it smells of gearbox oil, you know, like a sort of old car. And I remember walking in and going, yeah, maybe I've peaked too early. And that was that.
I think it's amazing that you had such a strong interest at a young age and you followed it and the influence of your mom. Ed, with your love of film, did you ever consider going into film as a career?
I'm still considering it. You know that. I didn't know how to get in. I didn't know anyone. Grew up in Brooklyn, so it was just easier to get into NASA, truthfully.
I like that. It was easier to get into NASA. You should get that put on a t-shirt.
It, you know, I was an idiot in the early 80s until I knew what I was doing in the late 30s. But so that was when I started, and I had an internship that got me into NASA, and I loved it. Great place, amazing place to work. If I could have figured out a way to get into movies or cinema, I definitely would have done that. But, you know, it's a lot of this, you know, is the experiences that you have and the who you know. And truthfully, you know, film in the 80s, I don't think was that attractive. You were talking about Lawrence of Arabia. I got the 4K version, and it explodes in sound and sight, and it's just... it's a marvel, and I see things that I never saw before. But you didn't have that in the 80s, and I didn't have a connection. But yeah, that's so I had to settle for NASA.
The Lawrence of Arabia is really interesting. I mean, it opens up concepts about how films should look and where 4K comes in. Like, is it actually necessary to have Lawrence of Arabia in 4K? And it is, but it comes with a lot of ethical problems in that. If you ever get the opportunity to see Lawrence of Arabia on 70mm, that's something else. So just to go to another film briefly, it's easier to explain the same thing. We did a film festival in last year in June called Film on Film, and it was a week of just films on original 35mm and 70mm and 16mm and 8mm prints at the BFI South Bank Cinema. And we discovered a print of Jaws in the National Film Archive that was from 1975, the year it was made, and it had never been projected. It was pristine. I think it maybe had been projected once just to see what it was, how it looked. And the colour was pristine because it's what was called a dye transfer print. Dye transfer is the main term for dye transfer is Technicolor. So it was a Technicolor print in that... the dyes are layered onto the surface of the emulsion rather than embedded in like Kodak. So it's not a film that reacts to light. The dyes are actually printed on top and they don't fade. So dye transfer never fades. It does become unstable, but in a very different way. But essentially, it doesn't fade. So when you're restoring films like Lawrence of Arabia or Jaws, if you can get hold of an original dye transfer print, you've got the original colour. And you can then make it look exactly as it did in 1975 or Lawrence of Arabia's 1960, 61, I think. Because obviously as in working in film preservation, you want to preserve the experience of seeing a film as it was when it came out. So when we had this print of Jaws, the other main point of it was it had the original mono optical track, which is the audio track down the edge of the film, which is literally, it looks like a little sound wave. and the light shines through it, it hits a diode, and that diode translates that light flickering into audio. And that's still a used technology today in cinemas. If the digital audio breaks down, it switches over to an optical track if you're showing a print. And that's like the most basic, you know, technology, and it's still being used. So anyway, it had the original mono audio track on the side of it. So we showed it at this film festival, and it was a completely, it was the main auditorium, so 450 odd people, sold out. My mum was there. She'd never seen Jaws. And there were people, I said, who hasn't seen Jaws? And quite a few people put their hands up. But there were people wearing Jaws, like clothes. Anyway, but part of my introduction was, this is probably the most overexposed, pardon the pun, film of all time. It's probably the most documented film of all time. It's the most analysed. It's got so many documentaries about it. But ultimately, what you're seeing this evening, unless you were there in 1975, you've never seen this. Because the way the brain works with moving images is, using Jaws and Lawrence of Arabia as an example, if you watch Jaws, be it digitally on a 4K digital cinema or on an original 35mm print that's in mint condition, your brain isn't going, oh, it's the shark movie. There's one big lump of your brain, there's one bit of your brain that is doing that, it's your memory. Your memory is going, I'm watching Jaws. Whereas the other part of your brain is going, I'm watching two completely different things. Because your brain reacts in very, very different ways, because one is entirely analog process using a different amount of light, and it's flickering and it's softer, and the other one is hard. And you know, I'm not saying that digital is any worse, but it's just a very different thing. It's a harder light. You're also looking at an image that is pin sharp, because the original negative of Lawrence of Arabia, the original 65mm negative of Lawrence of Arabia was used. They scanned it directly from that negative, and that's why you see things you never saw before. And sometimes you weren't supposed to see, because the process of making a film, the original negative is printed to what's called an interpositive, and then the interpositive is made into what's called a dupe negative. So you've got a generational loss through the film grain that softens, and then the prints are made off of that. So when they first restored Superman years ago, there were complaints because you could see the wires. And they went, well, that's the way it was shot. You go, well, no, because by the time the generational loss came along, they built in, when they were making the film, they factored in that when the prints were made, the film grain would have filled in the wires. And incidentally, modern technology for wire removal is the same technology we use to remove scratches in old films. That's where it comes from. Most of the tools that we use in digital film restoration go back to George Lucas. He basically developed the technology of film scanning. He developed the technology of putting digital back out to film. And he developed, obviously, the visual effects technology. I mean, he didn't do it himself, but his companies did. So the wire removal, all these sorts of things, it's the same technology we use to remove debris and fix tears and scratches digitally, and then obviously make brand new film prints. So in a way, when you watch Lawrence of Arabia or a Blu-ray or a DVD of Jaws, you're seeing those films and they look amazing, but they're not the same film that you saw in 1961 or 75. The colors are not the same.
That's okay, because they're better. Yeah, I understand, because this is, artists do things and they want to own it the same way forever, but life goes on.
I mean, I don't let it. I will watch these films on Blu-ray and DVD myself, absolutely. But if I ever get the opportunity to see film, that's like seeing the Mona Lisa in person rather than seeing a card of the Mona Lisa. That's the way I see it. And the other thing about seeing Jaws with the mono track, and I made a big point about this when I introduced it, was your brain is also seeing a different film, because you're looking at different parts of the images that you maybe didn't look at before, because the mono track is there. Whereas when you've got a surround sound, you can hear things behind you. Your eyes might go up there because something's going on. The sound is over there. The stereo sound is drawing you to places. Whereas what you do appreciate more is the framing that Spielberg did and the way he composed his shots. And it's a different experience.
I mean, what I like about restorations is I think you're giving love to something that maybe people have forgotten for a while. You know, a movie that was done 100 years ago, that, you know, some of those really wonderful Universal movies. I like a lot of those kinds of gothic things. When you see the original version, I can appreciate them. And sometimes I enjoy just that this is what it was seen. But then when they get updated, restored, they're different. But this creates, I think, to me, a new appreciation of, oh, you know, wow.
That's a concept that I like to call preservation through distribution, which basically means that part of the preservation process is making a film available, and as long as a film is available, it exists. So, for instance, the Billy Connolly film I talked about earlier, Big Banana Feet, the only reason that exists is because it was sent out to a cinema and they forgot to return it. Part of the preservation and restoration process at the BFI always ends with a brand new 35mm film element being made, as well as a digital copy being made, so that we preserve that experience.
So, Doug, this is exciting because I'm sensing that you might be bringing the film versions to the moon in addition to some of the digital.
Well, that's difficult because I need a projectionist. I need a...
Whatever you need, you have. Jessica has an unlimited budget.
We do need to get to your last and it sounds like ultimate film.
My last film, which is my favorite film of all time.
Hold on, we need a drum roll.
Well, there's a lot of drums in this film. I'm going to give you some clues. So there's a lot of drums, and big drums.
Hard Day's Night?
No. You're near in that it's black and white. That's as close as you get.
What's the film about the Jeremy Irons in the jungle?
No, Jeremy Irons. You're close. But I'm not going to let you have any more clues. There's drums.
Apocalypse Now.
It's a film that encapsulates almost everything that we've been talking about, and it's my favorite film of all time. I own a print of this film. It's King Kong.
Wow, brilliant.
No, that's so interesting.
The 1970s classic. No, no, the original 1930s King Kong.
Don't be alarmed, ladies and gentlemen. Those chains are made of chrome steel.
Wild, weird, wonderful, the stuff for which movies were made. Adventure, to make you wonder if it's true, while your eyes convince you that it is. Truly, the thrill of thrills. Don't miss it this time.
We just had a brand new film print made of it from Film Elements held at Warner Brothers. So we've got a beautiful pristine 35mm print at the BFI. And if it ever shows in the cinema, I always send people to go and see it. If you're ever in Glasgow, because I know you're up that way, GFT might show it. They showed King Kong. But even if they show it digitally, go and see it. But yeah, King Kong. And it goes with my request of an object, because you said I could take an object. I didn't realize it wasn't objects and some food. I'm going to have to think of food quickly. But my object was, can I please take a monkey?
Yes, as long as you can promise to care for it.
You know, I will care for it because it's going to care for me. It's going to be like a monkey pal. And he's going to, because I need someone to help operate the spacecraft and I need someone to just help out, you know, and farm my little sort of patch of vegetables with me and just chat and hang out with and play cards, smoke cigars.
I like a little monkey companion. That's a good idea.
And also he won't speak. He won't speak, so I won't have to have arguments. He just makes noises and he have a little suit on and he can be my pal, you know.
I love
that. That's all I need.
Getting back to King Kong. Why is that your ultimate favorite?
One of my earliest memories of the idea and the concept of cinema is King Kong, because my grandmother, she saw King Kong in the cinema. And I remember her telling me about it, not after she'd seen it, because I wasn't alive, I remember her telling me as a little kid about this film. And I remember it being on BBC. So BBC Two and Channel Four were an absolute goldmine when I was a kid of old movies, because we didn't have all the channels. We had like four channels. I remember King Kong. My favorite movie studio and era for Hollywood movies is RKO, 1930s through to early 50s. That's my era. That's my studio. It's not my studio. I wish. That would be, if I could go back in time, that's where I'd work. That or with Chaplin doing the mutual comedies. Those would be the bits I'd go to. So King Kong. And I remember as a little boy, I mean, very young, being in a movie memorabilia shop in St. Ives, of all places. And my mum allowed me to get a King Kong action figure. And I was obsessed with my King Kong action figure. I had a King Kong jumper. So when all the other kids were into skateboarding and smoking and stuff.
You were cool.
Yeah, they were on Glasgow doing drugs and sort of bad things. And I'm like that. I've got a King Kong jumper. I then obviously saw the film and it was my entry drug. That and Alfred Hitchcock films were my gateway to cinema, because Hitchcock films are so literate. that you can watch them and you feel like you're feasting on the language of cinema. It's so accessible. And I remember as a teenager just devouring those Hitchcock films again on the BBC. And it was back when the BBC used to have actual film documentaries and you'd learn about, I remember being a whole 45-minute documentary on the BBC just about crane shots. You don't get that now. But the so King Kong, to me, it ticks every single box in that as a technician, it rewrote the language of cinema and it basically broke the mold. So much so that film didn't actually catch up. Technology didn't catch up. Technique didn't catch up with King Kong until the 60s, if you ask me, maybe even the 70s. But it invented so many processes. It invented the concept of music being cut to action. No other film had done that. But films before that were just guys in bow ties mixing cocktails with jazz music, in sort of plush Manhattan apartments. Whereas then you're in the jungle with Kong and the drums. Dun, 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 dun. Hey, what's that wall keeping out? It's what it's keeping in, you know. But and you're just a little kid. And again, you're traveling with it. You're going. And I like to believe there is a Skull Island now in real life. You've got to have that concept of wonder, otherwise you're over, you know. Just because it's not on Google Earth doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Because we live in an era where everything is fact. Even if it isn't fact, there's no mystery and wonder anymore. As a kid, and even now, that's what sci-fi, and I don't really like fantasy films. This is probably the only fantasy film I really like, actually. But what I also love about it, as I've got older, as a guy who studied and practiced animation as well, the technique of the film is unreal. The complexity of the visual effects is unreal. There's layers and layers and layers of everything going on. There's live action in a corner, then Kong's here, then there's glass, and there's all sorts of things moving in and out. It's so complex and ahead of its time. And it moves like a modern action film. When you watch it now, it just moves. It's such a good, it's not a quick film. I'm not saying it's over quickly, but it is just a really tightly made film. The acting's ropey. That's what you want from an RKO adventure film. It's kind of stiff 30s Hollywood, like, why, gee, I think I love you. That's what, and then Fay Wray goes, why, Ed, I thought you hated women. You know, it's all that sort of. But then and it's slightly dubious in its racial stereotypes, but it's 1930s Hollywood. But Kong himself, it goes back to the concept of men being idiots. Kong is just a guy who's angry because he can't express what he wants. He's like, you don't understand me. And I just want the woman and she doesn't even get it. And then, it's that, you can relate to him. But then you look at it, you go, and, I still cry at the end of King Kong. But you think, why am I crying? He's clearly an inanimate object who's got like fingerprints and, it's clearly a little doll. But the point is that encapsulates what's amazing about cinema is you can take something completely inanimate like this button and make people feel sorry for it just by telling a really good story. I mean, that ending with the planes, it just moves. It's incredible. And every person I've taken to see that has just been like, oh my God, I thought this was going to be a really two-dimensional, stiff 1930s film. It's like, well, yeah, most films back then, adventure films, were very different. This was so unique. For years, it was a unique film. And as I said, technology and cinema technology, it caught up with it eventually. And if it wasn't for Kong, you wouldn't have modern Hollywood. You just wouldn't exist. We went to see, in fact, it's the only film I've seen twice in the cinema in a very long time recently. We went to see Godzilla Minus One. And I've never really been into Godzilla. I've seen the original one. I mean, being so into King Kong, you think I would be, but I'm not really. King Kong's an anomaly.
Totally agree with you.
It's an anomaly, yeah.
Well, King Kong was the human element in that movie. You cheer for King Kong. The humans are basically disgusting, and so when their heads are being ripped by his fingers, you're cheering that.
Yeah, it's an incredibly violent film as well. And there's that big bit where his big foot comes down and sort of squeezes him into the mud, and it's clearly a fake foot. I mean, I was reading recently that even at the time, film reviews were saying that the visual effects were clearly slightly hokey. He still looks very much like not a real, monkey or gorilla because he's. But that's not the point. The point is you're sucked into it because it's done so well and you believe it because the story is so compelling. But Godzilla Minus One was the first film in a long time of that sort where I felt, it's kind of not nailing it like King Kong, but it's in that area. because it was a great film about people that just so happened to have a giant lizard in it. Before it, they showed the trailer to the new Hollywood one, which has got their version of King Kong in it, and it just looks rubbish. It's like a 200 million flop.
And when I watch these old movies like King Kong, if you analyze it logically, then you could say, oh, this is fake, this is... But that's not how the brain works. The brain hears a story, and we create our own dream. So in many ways, I think that's even more powerful than when something is so perfect.
Absolutely. I mean, don't get me wrong. It had sequels, and they're not great. And King Kong is, or Kong has appeared in other films. It's not the same guy. There's only one King. I quite liked the Peter Jackson one. It was all right. Yeah, the original is just an absolute masterpiece, in my opinion. And I've seen a lot of films.
And some people complain about the slowness at the beginning, but I think that you're basically signing up for a journey.
The first minute or two of that film, you're right, you're in it. It's like, where are you going? Skull Island. He's like, well, I'm in. If it's called Skull Island, I'm going.
This may be the best selection of a movie to the moon in the entire series.
I just want to make a point, though, because people often dismiss old movies. They go, ah, I got a twin brother who's a fisherman, right? He won't watch films if they're black and white or if they've got subtitles. Whereas I believe if you're really going to say I'm a movie fan, man, you've got to go to every single corner and you've got to watch everything, even the trash. There's some amazing trash films that I absolutely love that people have never even heard of that maybe don't even exist. You know, they're so rare and weird that I've somehow seen them. Like stuff like this. I mean, who's seen that?
He's holding up a DVD of The Severed Arm.
There's a psycho loose with an axe, and his speciality, the severed arm. I mean,
and have you seen this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, you've seen it?
I totally agree that. You know, one of the things that drives me crazy with my kids is they don't like, if a movie is black and white, then they think it's old, it's not worth it watching. Or if it doesn't have special effects, maybe you get to a certain point, you know, in your mid to late 30s, where basically these are stories of our collective ancestry as humans. And the fact that they're at different stages, I think they're even more enjoyable. They're very powerful because we become a part of it.
I hate to do this, but whether we like it or not, we're going to have to launch Doug into space. Doug, we are allowing you a snack, but an infinite amount of that one snack and a book. So what is your favorite movie snack?
I don't do movie snacks. I can't stand food in the cinema.
So what's your favorite pre or post movie snack?
This is really British, but it has to be an infinite amount of fish and chips with salt and vinegar.
You got it. With tartar sauce?
No tartar sauce. No. Oh, no. Oh, no, actually, yeah, maybe a wee bit, but salt and vinegar at least.
Now we're talking.
That is yours, and you can take a book. What book would you like to take with you?
Yeah, thank you. Because I thought Desert Island Discs that you take they say, do you want to take the Bible or the works of Shakespeare? And I'm like, neither.
Neither. I know. That's exactly how I feel. Yeah.
The 39 Steps by John Buchan, the original Scottish adventure novel.
The film version was filmed down here. We're in Southwest Scotland, where we are.
That's right. Are you talking about the original black and white one?
Yes.
Great film.
Doug, your selections are so profound. I feel like they all are innovators in their own way. They all have genuine heart in their own way, and they're all visually stunning. They really make the most of a visual cinema. So I'm very excited that you're adding those to the collection on the moon.
Go for launch.
T-minus
30
seconds.
Just to end on my favorite moon quote for Wallace and Gromit, everybody knows the moon's made of cheese, so I won't get hungry.
Bye, Doug.
My monkey says goodbye as well. Bye.
Safe trip, Doug.
Take care. Share some of the fish and chips with the monkey.
Thanks for having me. I hope I don't be sick on the way up. Don't close the door. Bye.
Power and telemetry nominal. Vehicle supersonic.
Thank you so much to Highlands and Islands Enterprise and Light Dark Light for the opportunity of populating the moon with some of our favorite people.
Moon Snacks was hosted by Jessica Fox and Ed Hoffman with special guest Doug Weir. It was produced, edited, and with original music and sound design by me, Ben Please.
Brought to you in partnership with Highlands and Islands Enterprise, the Economic and Community Development Agency for the North and West of Scotland, hie.co.uk.